I'd like to cover a number of different shailas that came up during this period of time. And I'm going to refer to the pages that you may have received if you're on David's list. First page is Tzadi Hey, that's where we're going to start. And what we're going to see here is an overview by Rav Nosson Feldman, one of the young upcoming stars here in Israel, on many different issues, the first of which is related to what we discussed in the past, but it's much more direct and much more concise. His case is a person who tests positive, and instead of observing the laws of quarantine, he finds himself deliberately amongst other people, and other people are infected by him. There was no one else in their proximity except for him who could have possibly infected them. So this case, as opposed to the case that we discussed last week where there was a doubt and there was no certainty, here we have absolute knowledge that Reuven will call him infected others. And as a result, those others suffered perhaps some financial losses in terms of medical fees, lost time at work, suffering which is called tsar in halacha, and there are many different ramifications financially. The question is whether these individuals have recourse to compensation from this individual who deliberately violated the laws of the health department and so forth that require quarantine. And the issue at stake is Nezikin, but specifically, we have a distinction between what's called Mazik Biyadayim, direct Hezek, as opposed to Grama, as opposed to indirect Hezek. Now, a classic case of indirect Hezek would be, let's say, you sent an animal, somebody else's animal, to eat from poison. The animal ate the poison and died. Does the owner of the animal, we call him the Nizak, have recourse to sue for damages? And the Gemara says that in such a case, there is a ptur, an exemption from damages, which is called grama. And the Gemara gives another case, a very famous case in Bava Kamma Memches, and that is a shar, which I didn't watch carefully. It was my responsibility to watch the shar, and it falls into a pool of water, a cistern of water, and hivish mirecho, and as a result of the filth or the stench of the animal, the water is no longer drinkable. And the Gemara says that that's called grama benizikin. It's an indirect damage, and as a result, we have the following two rules. Number one, potter bedini adam, you have no recourse to sue in a court of law, chayav bedin shamayim. However, on a moral level, midin shamayim, you have to pay damages. Shall we apply these cases to our scenario of a person who deliberately violates the laws and the requirements of quarantine and exposes others who in fact come down with the disease? Let's add a third case in the Gemara. The Gemara says that the reason why you are not chayav bedinei adam in the case of grama, for example, if let's say you put something toxic in front of an animal, your friend's animal, is because, says the Gemara, habehema hivias atzmel es hanezek, the animal did the act of eating the poison. This is already a new perspective on grammar. From the perspective of the mazik, putting and placing this toxic substance in front of the animal might be considered a maisa biyadayim. He actively placed the toxic substance in front of the animal. Why is it called grammar? And the nizek has no recourse to damage in a court of law, because the nezek required A plus B. It wasn't enough that the mazik places the toxic substance in a place that's accessible to the animal, but more than that, the animal has to go ahead and do an action of eating this substance. And therefore, since we have what we call in Hebrew a shituf pula, we have a combination or a partnership, if you will, of two different actions, that of the mazik and that of the nizak, the animal in this case. Therefore, it's called grama. Now, based on this, the poskim want to analyze the case that we discussed here with regard to corona. On the one hand, you could clearly say, and many poskim seem to put forward this claim, that the nizak, the person who came down with the disease, he breathed in the air of the mazik, of the person who was infected. And therefore, it's exactly parallel to the case where the animal consumed the toxic substance. It wasn't enough that the mazik exhaled air. Somebody, in this case the nizak, had to inhale the air. So there's the exhale and the inhale. There's the placing the toxic substance in front of the animal, and there's the eating of the animal. Other poskim say that if you want a perfect analogy to the case of the animal that ate the toxic substance, it would have to be a case where the infected, the mazik, breathed onto a substance or touched a surface, and then the nizak came in contact with that surface. That would be, no doubt, grama ben izikin. Less man de polik, there's no debate about it. However, in the case of the nizak breathing in the air, there's an entire school of poskim who want to claim that in this case, the mazik is chayev. It's not grama. It becomes grama when the animal decides to eat this substance. But when the nizak breathes in the air and there's no clue in the world, there's no way that anyone, unless you had an electroscanning microscope, anyone could predict which air is infected with the virus and which air the nizak chose, so to speak, to breathe in, that would be parallel to the animal that chose to eat this particular substance. But here, a person is just breathing. That's not only natural, but it's a necessary function of the lungs, of the body. The body has to take in oxygen. And here, all the shift and all the blame is on the mazik. Then, we have a third school of thought. So, in the first two schools of thought, just to summarize, we vacillate back and forth. Is this similar or not similar to the classic grama case in a person who's meniach sam hamoves lifnei behema? But now we have another element in the equation. Even if I grant you that the mazik here is a gorem, we have something called garmi. And the Gemara establishes in Masechet Bava Kamma, in Perek HaChovel, that even if grama ben izikin is potur, garmi is chayef. Now, what's the difference between grama and garmi? All I could tell you is that garmi is a much more direct hezek. It's not 100% direct, but it's close to direct. For example, the classic garmi case would be if Reuven burns Shimon's shtar, a document that Shimon needs to collect whatever money was borrowed from him and payments that are due to him. He no longer has the ability to collect that debt. That's Garmi, because you could almost define that document as something that has its own value to it, insofar as it's the only basis for Shimon's claim in Beis Din to get back the money. It's almost like a check, and therefore there was a direct action in burning that check. Nevertheless, it's not really a maisa b'yadayim. It's not what we call mazik b'yadayim, a direct hezek, because this document is worth the paper that it's written on. So if it's written on a piece of very fancy vellum that you could sell in the market for a sofer to write a sefer Torah, okay, so pay him a couple of Canadian or Israeli shekels for it, and that's it. That's about the end of the story. The fact that the owner of the document, the Nizak in this case, can no longer sue in a court of law and force his lovet to pay up the damages, that's already indirect. But nevertheless, the Gemara classifies it as Garmi. So some of the poskim want to suggest that Garmi upgrades the level of Pshia on the part of the Mazik, because in every case of Grama, the Pshia goes down. It works like this. There are two factors. One goes up, one goes down. They are converse factors. The more it's Maisa B'Yadayim indirect, the less the Nizak is guilty, and the more negligence we can place on the shoulders of the Mazik. However, the less the Maisa of the Mazik was direct, the less of a Pshia, of a negligence, there was on the part of the Mazik. And we can understand that very well. For example, in the case where you feed the animal, since it was indirect, the animal decided on its own to eat the poison, then we can reduce the level of negligence of Pshia on the part of the Mazik. And the Mazik has at least a little bit of an opening to claim, well, I didn't expect the animal to eat the toxic substance. You know, it doesn't smell too good. However, in this case, where a person deliberately violated the laws of Bidud, which means that the government told him to go into quarantine simply because the government anticipates that in close proximity he will cause the infection, he will transfer the virus to the other people, the level of negligence here is equal to that of Maisa B'Yadayim. And therefore, it's like Garmi, just like in Garmi, there's very little mitigating factor here to lower the level of negligence. You went ahead, you burned somebody's shtar deliberately. You are absolutely negligent. That's what makes Garmi upgraded to the level of a Maisa B'Yadayim, even though, again, it's an indirect hezek. And here, too, some of the poskim want to say that the money that was lost can be sued for compensation because it is Garmi. So we have a double suffix over here. Number one, we're not sure if this is a Maisa B'Yadayim or it's Grama. And the reason to say that it's not Grama is because when the Nizak breathes the air, we expect him to breathe the air. That's not a decision on his part to choose which air is foul and has an infection in it, which is healthy. But even, this is what we call in Gemara language, afilim tim tzaloma, I grant you that there is a grama element here, because at the end of the day, the victim was the one who breathed in the air, like the animal that ate. Nevertheless, it could be that it's not grama, but it's garmi. And garmi applies even in a case of an indirect hezek, as long as we can prove that the action that was done was absolute pshia. Joe?
I just want to clarify the what's the difference between the surfaces and the air? I'm sorry.
Oh, excellent. In the case of the surfaces, there are two maisim going in two different directions, so to speak. The mazik, we'll call him Reuven, breathed onto a surface, or he touched the surface with his hands. Right now, the infection, the virus, is on a piece of metal or whatever the substance might be. The Nizak now puts his hand onto that platform, onto that surface, and he contracts the disease. That's exactly parallel to the case of the animal. The animal decides to eat and picks up the toxic food. That for sure is Groma bin Ezekiel. But if we have reason to believe, and again you have to know some of the medical aspects here which we're not going to get into, but you can prove that the Nizak breathed in the air that came directly from the Mazik. Can you imagine two people standing face to face and one blows air into the other breathes it in? That's not similar to the case of the animal. Or is it similar to the case of the animal? Because at the end of the day, the victim had to breathe in the air. Now, everybody agrees that even if I classify something as grama, nevertheless, there's a chiyuv bedin shamayim. But now we have to ask ourselves the following question. How far does this chiyuv bedin shamayim go? And let's offer two possibilities. One possibility is that it's a moral obligation. You want to be a good guy? You'll come up to Shamayim and Shamayim will say, hey, you caused someone damages. He'll say, well, I paid for it. I compensated. The other way of understanding it is that a Chiyuv Bedin Shamayim is exactly identical to a Chiyuv Bedin Adam with one important distinction, and that is whether it could be forced and enforced by the Beis Din. The Meiri writes at the beginning of Perek HaKones in Bava Kamma that if a person doesn't pay when he's Chayav Bedin Shamayim, he's Posel Yedus. He has the status of a gazlan. He's a thief. And what do I derive from this Meiri? That a Chayav Bedin Shamayim is not just a moral obligation. It's not just V'yosisa Yoshev Atov, do what's right. Because if somebody doesn't fulfill and live up to the standards of V'yosisa Yoshev Atov, he's not a gazlan, he's not Posel Yedus. If the Meiri says that he didn't pay up and he's a gazlan, it means that the Meiri understood that a Chiyuv Bedin Shamayim is a Chiyuv Mamon, and you are obligated monetarily to compensate him, and if you fail to do so, you're a gazlan, you're holding on to his money. Now again, I offer this for those who like to see the text inside. We're up to page Tzadivav. And here we have a slightly different scenario. A person contracted a disease. He has to go into quarantine. And li'achar shadover nisparer chivu arishio says kol anoshim shoyus vivosav likomes libidu. And again, I don't know if in your part of the world this is the same, but here in Israel, it's mind-boggling. I mean, it's like the KGB. They know exactly who is exposed to the person who tested positive. How do they know that? I mean, they're not Malachi Asharis. And basically, they do a tracking through the telephone. They have other methods, by the way. And if, let's say, for example, you were at a wedding together with someone who was infected, they will contact you on the phone and tell you that you're now in a 14-day quarantine. They're changing the laws a little bit, and it's going to go down to, I think, if I'm not mistaken, 11 days. Now, you have an obligation and a requirement to go into quarantine, and you fail to do so. Later on, you tested positive. Others with whom you came in contact because you were not careful about quarantine also likewise contracted the disease. Rav Nosson Feldman, here in this Sefer, Haviani Chadarov, quoting many, many poskim, says that in this case, everybody agrees that he's Chayav Bedin Shamayim. However, it's very less likely, shall we say, to argue that he be chayav bedin adam. In the case of a person who is himself infected, and he knows for sure that he's infected, he violates the rules of the government, of the Ministry of Health, and so forth and so on. He is a walking time bomb, so to speak, as far as the infection is concerned. And we do know, unfortunately, here in Israel, of cases where people were infected and they went deliberately and infected others. Deliberately, I mean to say that they violated the laws. Now, here in the footnote, he says,
he
says that in many countries of the world, the fact that you were in the same location or in close proximity to someone who tested positive, that doesn't require you to go into quarantine, as it does here in Israel. He says, I don't believe that that would make any difference in halacha. Why? Because the very moment that he was exposed to someone who was infected, then the halacha would require that he go into quarantine. Even if the health requirements are, let's say, less severe in other countries than they are here in Israel, nevertheless, he is still considered a mazik, because he himself should be motivated and should, on his own initiative, go into bidud. And if he fails to do so, that's called pshia. And once again, he be chayav bidin shamayim. Now, in Sif Gimel, he says, what happens if a person violated the laws of the health department and then he tested positive? Other people, as a result, have to go into bidud. Does he have to pay them damages for the bidud itself as a result of their being quarantined because he violated the quarantine? Now, they've lost weeks of work and this should be a chiyuv to pay what's called Sheves, under the law of Hachova B'Chavero. And here we have a tremendous debate amongst the poskim. A person who contracted the disease because he violated the laws, he exposed himself and then was determined to be infected, and now, as a result, other people have to go into quarantine. Does he have to pay them damages that are incurred by the quarantine itself? Gigantic machlokes. No one says that he's chayav b'dinei adam, but there is a school of thought amongst the poskim that he'd have to pay b'din shamayim. However, there are other cases that came up with a person who came in contact with food stuff, and as a result, if that food was in, let's say, a yeshiva or a public dining hall, and now he knows that he should have been in quarantine, instead he ate in the dining hall and he infected the food stuff, other people ate the food and they contracted the virus, that's a discussion here as well. But what interests me the most of all, which you'll see on page Tzadi Zion, is the question of a moser. In halacha, in the laws of damages, there's a new category called a moser. A moser is someone who damages someone else by saying the wrong words. He goes over to the government and he tells the government, which is what we call snitching, that so-and-so is guilty of cheating on his taxes. And as a result, the government comes and either throws this person into jail, prosecutes him, or at the very least, imposes very strict fines that have to be paid, penalties. And the Gemara says that there's a halacha called a moser. A moser could be chayav for gufo, if he's moser gufo, shel chavero, or moser mamono shel chavero. And here, the discussion comes up. This has been a very heated issue. I'll tell you who got involved. In Israel, with regard to Corona, if you know someone is not supposed to be where he is, you find him in shul when he's not supposed to be in the synagogue, you find him at a wedding when he's not supposed to be in the wedding, and you notify the authorities. That's called moser. As a result, here the fine is minimum 5,000 shekel, which is not something to sneeze at. And there are many rabbanim who say that you have to pay for that. In other words, I'm sorry, just the other way around. There are many, many rabbanim who say that not only are you exempt from damages, but you're obligated to notify the authorities. And the one at the head of the pack, and we've mentioned him time and time again, is none other than Rav Zelig Weiss, Rav Osher Zelig Weiss. And he paskins that you have to notify the authorities. And this became a big controversy in my shul, because he went a step further. And he said that you can embarrass this person publicly if he's not living up to the obligations of the health department. And even if he's not wearing a mask, you're allowed to throw him out of synagogue and embarrass him publicly. Now, you and I know that the Gemara equates embarrassing someone publicly with shvichas damim. It's only like almost like murder. But Rav Weiss says that this situation, this predicament that we're facing with the pandemic, is so dangerous that it even overrides the prohibition of Hamalbin es Pnei Chavero Barab. Rav Feldman, in his presentation here, says that Lamaisa, it's a very big controversy, and Tzorach Lasel Shelas Chachem B'chol Mikra L'Gufo, he says that you can't make this decision on your own. You would have to get a rabbinic authority to guide you and allow you to either be moser or to embarrass someone publicly. The last shaila in this context, which you'll see on page Sariches, and I'm very happy to say we've covered already four pages, which is more than I thought in such a short period of time, gives us the balance of the shiur to discuss the main topic for today, is, let's say the government allows you up to 20 people in the synagogue, a 21st person shows up. In our synagogue, for example, we require registration. Anyone who's not registered is not invited. But in this case, somebody showed up. He's number 21 or number 11, whatever the numbers are. And as a result, the what we call here, again, I don't know if you use this term in your part of the world, a Corona czar. Every community, every synagogue has to have a Corona czar and a Corona vaad, a committee. Now the police come in and they see that there are 11 people. There are 21 people. They're only allowed 10. They're only allowed 20. And the police here are brutal. And you can quote me on that. And they write out a penalty, which could be for a synagogue as much as 10,000 shekel. And the question is, do they have a right, the members of the synagogue, and especially the coronavirus czar, because he's personally responsible, the police have his name, and that's how it works in the synagogues here. Can he force that 11th guy, who had no right to be there, to carry the burden of that fine, of that penalty? And one of the poskim here in Eretz Yisrael, his name is Rav Gross. He's the final posek in, if I'm not mistaken, in Shuafat. Anyway, he writes that it could be that in this case everyone has to chip in equally to pay the penalty, because they should have made sure that this person would not be allowed entry, and if he entered, to force him to leave. Now I want to get on to the main topic for today, and that is the mitzvah of makeh. Now you might ask me, what does the mitzvah of makeh have to do with Piskei Corona? And again, I know the situation in Clanton Park is improved, but we're a little bit behind you, and here the minyanim are taking place outdoors. Now, above me, four flights above me, right exactly where I'm sitting, there's a gigantic porch of one of my closest friends, and the local minyan the local Ashkenazi synagogue, which is called the Dutch, it actually has a name, Heichal Dvir, is davening three times a day on my friend's porch. So what happens with the mitzvah of Makkeh? And we're going to ask two questions. Number one, is the situation today where an entire community has designated a certain roof as a synagogue, is that called temporary or is that called permanent? Number two, how do you classify davening, prayer? Is that called dira or is it not called dira? And dira means residence. Classic residence would be eating, sleeping, other activities that usually take place in a private setting. That's called residence. Does prayer constitute residence? Now, Rabosai, please make note of it. If we come to the conclusion that there's a chiyuv makkeh in the case of an outdoor synagogue on a roof, and we'll see again the shiurim, how high up the roof is, and how high the makkeh has to be, who has to pay, who has to foot the bill for the makkeh? Is it the entire community? Is it the host because it's the gag of his house? And these are the the shailas that came up in contemporary halachic history. So first let me read to you the shaila. He says, Rabim mispalim al gagim shel batim. Gagim shel binyonim. Upa'amim rabos. Very often, begagos elu ein makeh asara tfachim. The minimum height of a makeh has to be 10 tfachim, like any machitza. Ela bizmanim regilim kimat shelo yotzim lisham. On a general basis, certainly in the cold climates, very rarely do we go out to the roof. Maybe when the weather is good, you know, we'll hang up some laundry on the roof. And if you're lucky enough to have a beautiful view from your roof, that's where you'll climb up to see the view. Hint, hint about my friend upstairs. He has a gorgeous view. You're like in a helicopter over all of the hills around Yerushalayim. But as a general rule, you could not define a gag under normal circumstances as a makom dira. However, we're living through unusual times. And b'tkufa samagefa yotzim lispalel b'makom ze b'kvius. We are now davening on this roof on a permanent basis, three times a day, until further notice. Ha'im chayov lasos makke b'tkufas elu v'lahalon yesh lodin b'dover. This is an introduction. He says, now we're going to have to deal with this. He begins by... Yeah, go ahead, Joel.
Just a quick question, I'm sorry. The chiyuv of a makkeh around the roof, isn't it a responsibility for everybody at any time, as long as it has the ability to go up onto the roof? Isn't it a chiyuv right to begin with?
So this is a gigantic machlokas between the Rambam and the Ravid. And the Rambam's case is a case of something called a beis ha'otzar. He's got a storage house that has a roof to it. And the Rambam writes in Perek Yud Aleph Milchus Rotzeach Ushmir Sanefesh, because all the halachos of makkeh are codified by the Rambam Milchus Rotzeach, because the Torah says about makkeh, not only v'yosisa makkeh b'ugagech, but lo tamod al damriyecha, and the Rambam therefore classifies these halachos in Milchus Rotzeach. The Rambam writes that a base otzer v'chadome, in other cases, She'eno beis dira, poter mimakeh. In other words, when the Torah says put up a makeh on your bayis, on the gag of your bayis, the Torah is talking about a beis dira. And an otzar tvua, where you may use as a kind of a storage for your grains, that's not a makom dira. Nobody lives there. And in that sense, the Rambam will exempt many, many cases from the mitzvah of Makkah. However, the Raivan disagrees, and many Rishonim in this case, this is a little bit unusual, join hands with the Raivan and reject the Rambam, and they assume that I don't need a base dira in order to generate a chiyuv Makkah. As long as the gag could be used in any shape or form, like we said before, you hang up your laundry there to dry it, the gag is high enough to be a danger, and it requires a makkah, and that's a mitzvah d'oraisa. Now, it's interesting that the Beis Yosef himself, in his commentary on the tour, seems to vacillate back and forth between the Raivan and the Rambam. Because he was asked a question about a gag, whether it needs a makkah. The gag was used for laundry purposes. And he writes, Lefia emes, ein bazeh din makkah. His opening statement seems to indicate that you need a base dira, and he's accepting the Rambam's view. But then he goes on and he writes, the afal beach of min adin eino tzarch makkah, the kol sheino base dira eino chayv makkah, Kevan she'ein lo sham tashmish beis dira. He says, eino chayav b'makeh. Fine. So far, straight the Rambam. Listen to the Sefer, the end of the Beis Yosef. He writes, this is, by the way, if you're interested in Choshen Mishpat Siman Tavchav Zayin, he writes, afilu im timtza lomar, im yesh beis dira lamata, he says, even though the gag itself is not used for a dira, we don't sleep on top of the roof, but nevertheless, below the gag is a base dira. Hagag chayav b'makeh. So imagine the following scenario. I own a home, I own a house, and I invite you to use my gag to place your wet laundry. And he says the following, that im timtza lomar, if you want to argue that since the building itself, the structure itself, is a base dira, lamata, therefore the gag is chayev lamala in makeh, says the Beis Yosef, hamishtamish al gag chayev lasoso velo balabayis. To balabayis, even though it's his base dira, lamata, that generates the chayev makeh, he doesn't have to put up the makeh. Meaning, even if I grant you that the gag requires a makkah, it's the mishtamesh that is obligated in the makkah. And it's a very thin, what we call a dakastika point that he's making. It's a very sensitive chiluk. He's saying that although Reuven owns the house, and because the house is a base dira, it will generate a chiyuv makkah on the gag, if that gag is being used. But not because of the gag itself. The gag is not a base dira, but only because it's like an auxiliary or an extension of the bias. But nevertheless, the owner of the bias is not chayev, or not necessarily chayev, for makkah. Because if he's not the one who's using it, others are using it, they have to put up a makkah. And it's very fascinating that one of the great Sephardic poskim, his name is Ben Venisti, I have his sefer here, called the Knesset HaGdola. He writes that whenever the Beis Yosef uses the terminology im timtza lomar, he means to say the kach hu adin. So when the Beis Yosef says im timtza lomar kevin sheyesh beis dira lamata chayav makeh begag lamala, that's exactly how the Beis Yosef wants to pasuk. So on the one hand, the Beis Yosef accepts the Rambam, which means that a base otzer is not going to be chayev on the gag in a makeh, because there's no dira lamata, it's a base otzer. On the other hand, he accepts the Raivid's position, if there's a base dira lamata, the gag is chayev in a makeh. But as far as who's chayev in the makeh, that depends. If the owner of the house is using the makeh, I'm sorry, if the owner of the house is using the gag, he, the Baal HaBayis, is chayev in the finances, etc., in the physical tircha, putting up the makkah. If on the other hand someone else is using the makkah, then that someone else is chayev in makkah. So it's fascinating. I don't have to own the bayis, nor the gag for that matter, in order to be chayev in makkah. The very fact that I use the gag, and the gag is on top of a base dira, then in the way the Knesset HaGdolah understands the base Yosef, I, as a user, I'm a friendly user of the gag, I become obligated in makkah on your gag. And the poskim want to bring support to this understanding, not this understanding of the Beis Yosef, but this halacha and this rule from Rishonim. Apparently there's a Yad Ramah in Baba Basra who writes that even though Stam Gag eino meshamish ledira, right, who sleeps up on a gag? Very unusual. Maybe, you know, call it Ben Yefuna, you know, one of the Meraglim sleep up on a gag. I don't know. But nevertheless, the Yad Ramah writes, Afal Pichen, Kevan, Sha'ose Shimushim Acherim Bagag, Kishtichas Peros, like they used to dry their fruits up on the roof. That's enough, he says, Lechaiva Torah B'makeh. So that this breakthrough of the Beis Yosef actually finds its source in the Rishonim. The Rishonim saying that once you're using the gag for whatever tashmish it is, even though it's not a Beis Dira, you're chayev in makkah. The Rashba writes that if you have a gag that's eino roy l'shum shimush, here I have to invite Saul Kashitsky into the picture, right? Kigon, he says, gagos ra'afim. How do you say that in English? What business is Kashitsky in? What's it called?
Shingles.
Shingles. Oh, I haven't heard that word in a long time. Ever since I had my prava. We had it in Kashitsky's place. It was really interesting because he has aerial pictures of all his factories around the thing. So I got to see what shingles look like. Anyway, so if you have a roof made of shingles, the Rashba writes, Kevan she'eino roy l'shum tashmish, you know, I'd like to go up onto a slanted roof, like a shingled roof, and start doing something there. I mean, it's, you know, you might as well sign your own death warrant. Eino roy l'shum tashmish, l'chein patur, he's therefore patur from a makkah. The implication of the Rashba is that if it was a flat roof, even if he's not living there, he's not sleeping there, it's not Dira Mamish, but nevertheless he does certain Tashmishim and he uses the roof, that would be enough to generate a Chiyuv of Makkah. The only difference is that, as we said before, the Beis Yosef accepts the Rambam's view. If the entire structure is a base Otsar, then we're not going to say that because he uses the Gag occasionally or for some sort of Tashmish, therefore that Shimush generates a Chiyuv Makkah. But in a case of a base dira, and the gag is on top of a base dira, then we have the Knesset HaGdolah's reading of the base Yosef. We have the Yad Ramah in Baba Basra. We have the Truus of Rashba by implication. All these seem to assume that there's a Chiyuv Mak. The Chazon Ish seems to paskin that it all depends upon the level of danger on top of the roof. And he says that the Olam has accepted the perspective that if you have a roof that's dangerous, then by definition the Torah requires a mak. That is what's written here on page Tzadi Tes. Now we're going to go over to page Kuf. And he says, Gago Shelonu, our roofs, yesh b'hem shimush, let's say we use the roof, there are some roofs where you don't use it at all, im hem chayovim, he says, tzorich im, We're not sure if our roofs are chayev in a makkah, because olim sham rak letikunim. He says, again, describing one particular set of circumstance, one sociology, the metzias he's describing, he's addressing, is where we only go up to the roof when we need to make tikunim. You know, there are pipes, you know, sewage pipe. I don't know what tikunim he has in mind. We go up to the roof, but we don't have any other shimushim. Nobody climbs to the roof, not even lishtach peros, or not even to dry his laundry. He says, I'm not sure, and the post can vacillate whether you're chayev in makkah. But then he writes, Avol gag ha-meshamish l'tfilos im hu me'al beis dira chayev b'makkah. That the askomas ha-poskim is that although we can vacillate about our gagos, because in our gagos we very rarely go up there, if we go up there at all, it's just for tikunim, you know, once in 10 years. Well, if you live in Florida, it's probably once a year. But anyway, you know, I have a Talmud who's in roofing in Florida. You know, it's a very good business to go into. Anyway, if you designate an area for tefillah, then you're chayv in a makkah. But only under one condition, that the gag is on top of a beis dira. In other words, we're skirting the machlokas between the Rambam and the Ravid here, because the Rambam would say that you need a beis dira. So we're talking about a case where there's a gag, and we've made it into our synagogue on top of a beis dira. Now the issue is whether or not we consider shimush in a case where the only use he gets out of the gag is davening. And he quotes the poskim here that kevan shekavu makom tfilas sham lamala mi beis dira chayav. There is a chiyuv of makkah. And this again is an overview of many, many different poskim. He has a kula. He says, im rak chelek shel agag meshamish l'tfila. Like upstairs, my friend Alan has a great gigantic gag, because Baruch Hashem, it's two apartments that they combine. They had a great interior designer, by the way. I'm not going to mention her name. But anyway, he says that im dogim l'spalel b'chelek mesuya me'agan v'oso chelek Mishamish l'tfila is dailasos maka b'tzad shemishtamshim bo l'tfila. Now, honestly, he has his sources here in Adiyuk, in the Meiri. I have my doubts about this, personally, because if we go with the Chazon Ish's approach, what happens inevitably during davening is people move from side to side. You know, the Shatz is taking his time until he starts repeating Shmon Hesrei. People are getting fidgety, so they start walking. Especially, it's a beautiful view from the Gag. And if there's an element of danger, because there's no makkah on that side of the Gag, I don't know. Not sure why or how you could potter it. Okay, let's assume that we've established that we are going to daven on a regular basis on top of so-and-so's house on the Gag. Who has to pay for the makkah? And as we saw in the Beis Yosef and in Shulchan Aruch, achiyuv hu rak al bal zchut hashimush begag v'lo al bal habayis. I own the house. I don't use my gag. I'm not chayv in a makkah. You use my gag. True, I invite you. I'm the host for the shul. But you're the one who's benefiting from my gag. You, referring, ustedes, what we call in Spanish, right? You know, it's the whole group. You have to pay for the makkah. Kishe ein lo zchus shimush. However, if he says, you know what, I own the house, I'm not going to give you rights to use my gag. You know what? From time to time, even if it's very frequently, three times a day, I'm going to let you use my gag. But, you know, you're just sort of borrowing my gag. But I'm not going to establish some sort of a legal transfer of ownership. Then achiyuv mutal bal habayis. Why? Because the bal habayis is joining in tefillah. He too is being mishtamish with his bias. He has not transferred any monetary zchuyot, any rights to the members of the community, therefore he remains chayiv in the market. However, yachal lahasnos, he can make a tanai, and he could say, I'll give you permission, I'll host the minyan, but only on the condition she'atem tasu es hamaka, you will fulfill the requirement of the maka. And he's perfectly legitimate, because if not for the shul, if not for the tefillah, he would not be chayiv in maka. Now he has a whole discussion here, which is not relevant to us, as to who has to put up the maka physically. Can a guy put up the maka? So I'm sure that's very relevant all over the world. Here it's very relevant because, you know, a lot of the workers here are not Jewish. This I can tell you from my wife's profession. She hires many Arabs to work in her places. And here there's an issue with the Machna Ephraim. I don't want to get into it right now, but the Machna Ephraim is famous for saying that if you're paying this guy to put up the makah, he becomes what's called Yad Poel Kiyad Balabais. It's like your extended arm. And Rabbi Chanan is very famous, Rabbi Chanan Vassam, for saying that it depends how you understand makah. The Torah says, v'asisa makah legagecha. And if we take that literally, it means that the actual asiya, you know, literally putting up the makah is the mitzvah. But Rabbi Chanan says, nein, the mitzvah is not the asiya. V'asisa means guarantee that there's a makah and the safety up on your roof. Now he asks a question, if they use the shul on a temporary basis before they get up the market, is there an Iser involved? Very profound question. Okay, you've decided, we're davening there, we need a market, it's on top of Beis Dira, but in the meantime, I don't have the market. Do I cancel all my services until such time as we put up the market? It reminds me of the question of Tevilas Kalim, which also came up in this pandemic, about Pesach time, and we had the Shiloh right here in our kitchen. We had Kalim that needed Tevila. They were brand new Kalim that were manufactured in China. And the question was whether or not we could get access to a mikvah. There were no mikvahs to be had at that point. Not even mikvahs for Kalim. So the question was, can we use the keli on a temporary basis, understanding very well that once the mikvah is open, the first thing we're going to do is get online to be tovel the kli in a mikvah. Here also, we haven't yet put on up the makah. In the meantime, are we allowed to use the shul? And here he quotes a tshuva based on the Mordechai of the Marach. I'm not sure if that might be the Arzarua, one of the Rishonim, who says that ein iser b'etzem hashimush, that there's a chiyuv to put up a makah, and obviously it's a time urgent chiyuv, but the Torah didn't prohibit using the gag. There's no iser shimush. The maisa shimush itself is not asur, just that there's a chiyuv that is incumbent over your head to put up the makah. Now here, he has another insight of the Chazon Ish, and I need your help, because I don't understand the logic of the Chazon Ish. The Chazon Ish says the following. Let's say you have a gag before Corona that's not chayev in makah. It's not osu l'shimush. The Chazon Ish says that in such a case, you're not allowed to daven there without a makah. Why? Because your davening there, the community's prayer, is now a shimush. You have converted, you have transformed this gag, which was eno l'shimush, into a gag l'shimush. You're only allowed to do that if and when you fulfill the mitzvah of makah. So it's very interesting. On the one hand, we're saying that if the shul is stuck, in the meantime, they're davening on a gag, they have no choice, and there's no makah, that's not an avera, that's not an isur. There's no isur in the shimush itself. But if that shimush transforms the status of the makah and generates a chiyuv makah by establishing this gag as a makom shimush, then you're not allowed to do so without setting up a makah. I don't catch the logic. I mean, again, I get sehits, you know, I can get excited because I know, you know, intuitively I sense that he's making, breaking new grounds here. He's saying that the shul, if need be, could daven there, but when the shul decides that they are going to daven on this makah, they better get the makah up there first, because they, through their decision, have established that this gag is a gag shel shimush. They now, through their shimush, have engendered a chiyuv makah, and therefore they have to fulfill that chiyuv makah, you know, synchronize it with the shimush itself. Bobby?
How does sakana play into this?
Right, so the Chazon Ish is assuming right now that the people are mature and they'll be careful on the roof, and even though the roof is more than 10 tefachim high, it won't be a sakana, and therefore it all depends upon the mitzvah of makah. In terms of, excuse me, a dangerous situation, then the Chazon Ish insists that b'toras lo tosim dom ve'secho, you would have to put up a makah.
But in terms of tamei ha-mitzvahs for makah, I mean, ultimately the reason is because of sakana, no?
True, yeah, that's true, Bobby, but you have many situations where you climb up to a high place that's dangerous. And again, you know, in certain cases, maybe the halacha will prohibit it. But let's say the danger is relatively low probability. It's a 5% danger. So, for example, I'm not a mountain climber. And in Yirtzeh Hashem, I'll never climb a mountain. But there are people who climb mountains. There's no makah. In other words, they can take all the precautions, but at the end, they still expose themselves to danger. So, what I'm trying to drive at is that the A does not necessarily mean B. A, meaning exposing yourself to danger, doesn't automatically mean that you have to set up a makah. You could have a gag, and there is an element of danger, but it's like climbing a mountain. The halacha will determine and fix in stone exactly when you're chayav a makah. So that it's interesting. You could have tamei ha-mitzvahs, you could have a reason behind the mitzvahs, but then you have the geder ha-mitzvah. There may be conditions that the Torah sets up. And for example, in the case of the Rambam, you're on top of a base otzar. That's certainly a dangerous place to be, but yet the Rambam says you're not chayav a makah. Why? Because it's not a base dira. Now, how tall does the makah have to be? The makah has to be a minimum of 10 tefachim high. It has to be strong enough so that if somebody leans on the makah, it will not fall. But here we are rejecting another shita in the Rishonim that says that the makah, and again this comes back to your point again, Bobby, does not necessarily prevent me from falling off the roof. What it is it's a heker. Now again, you could always argue within the context of tamei ha-mitzvahs that according to that sheet that all you need is a heker, that that's going to reduce the statistical element of danger, and therefore I'm not chayv in a makah. But they go a step further. They want to say that once you set up a heker bialma, you have already fulfilled this mitzvah of makah. That's a very strange halacha. It means that there are two definitions of what a makah is. Is a makah a physical substance, sturdy enough, strong enough to resist the weight of a person when he leans on it? Or is a makah some sort of halachic conceptual entity, which is called a heker? You know, when I learned these halachas, I feel a little bit at home, because it reminds me of Erevin. You know, you have, like, for example, a mavui or a chotzer that has many different residents that join and partner in this mavui and this chotzer, and you set up a heker. Because a lechi or a korah, I mean, again, you're getting into real heavy issues in Erevin, but according to one school of thought, it's only a heker. And finally, on the last page here in this section about makah kuf dalid, he sets up a discussion here about how you know, how do you establish a makeh? Is it a, he writes, the name of the Pasa Shulchan, that Nasebo Kilkul, Tikkun is a Maisa Hejot. He gets into various dinim about fixing up a makeh if it's partially broken. And what happens? You have a maskir and a socher. You have a person who owns the house and he rents it out to someone else. Does the renter have to fix up the makeh if it breaks? And it all depends upon whether fixing up the makeh is a maisa hejot or maisa uman. And this is the overlap between makeh and mesechta moed kot. Okay, now if you can open up to the next page, we're fast forwarding, just give me 1 minute, Joe, to page Kuf Zion. And this I found fascinating. So I remember watching a wedding in Toronto recently of the son of a very good friend of ours, of mine, of yours. And the son, the chassan with his kala, is now, Baruch Hashem, here in Eretz Yisrael. He's learning in the Mir. And I was curious to know whether or not the Masada Kedushin, one of the great Rabbanim of Toronto, we're all fans of his, would require Yesh Ladun Lahoros Li Ede HaChupa Lahasir Es HaMaseicha Bizman HaChupa, to be makpid that the chasan and the kala should remove their masks when the Edim are seeing the Mesiras HaTabas, the Maisa Kedushin. And to go a step further, not only should the Chassan and Kala remove their masks, but the Edim themselves have to remove their masks so that everyone could recognize the Edim. And the reason for this is we need Edu Shatayochel Azima. Fascinating question. A whole discussion here in the Poskim. And before we get to the issue itself, I just find it interesting that the premise of the poskim is that it's very difficult to recognize a person who's wearing a mask. Thank God we're learning on Zoom. Otherwise, you would know, you wouldn't have any clue who's teaching the class. Now the Israelis are, I don't know if you have this in Toronto as well, they're advertising a certain kind of mask that, you know, is see-through, you know, but it's very close to the face, it covers the nose, it covers the mouth, you know, it's hermeneutic sealed. Anyway, so the issue here is Eidu Shateichu Lazima. We have two categories of testimony. We have something called Eidus Lebirur HaDavar, and we have Eidus Lekiyum HaDavar. So for example, in a criminal case, we need Eidus Lebirur HaDavar. The Eidim have to see the action in order to testify about it. They witness the violation and then they can testify it. No question about it, hands down. Eidus Lebirur HaDavar requires Eidus Shateichel Azima. Then another two Eidim could come along and testify about these first two witnesses who are now in Beis Din, that they were with us in a different place at that time. They couldn't possibly have witnessed the crime. But then we have another category called Eidus Lekiyum HaDavar. And in Eidus Lekiyum HaDavar, if the Rav HaMesader knows that and recognizes these two witnesses, he may tell them to do tshuva under the chuppah to make sure they're ksherim, then that would be enough for Eidus Lekiyum HaDavar. If two other witnesses will testify against them, they'll say, you made a boo-boo, you made a mistake. That's not us. You can't identify us. We're wearing masks. But we don't require Eidus Shateichel Azima in Eidus Lekiyum HaDavar. We just need to set up the Kiddushin, to set up the Ishus. And for that, we need just to engage in the Maisa Kiddushin. And finally, because I know my time is out, two last very quick shilas, and then we'll open up for questions. Number one, you're davening outside in front of an apartment in the Chatzer. And you have a group of 10 people, 20 people, whatever it is. Now, one of the members, residents of that house, wants to go into the building. And there's an Iser al-Yavar Keneged HaMispal Dalet Amos. Wait a second. I want to get home. I want to have access to my apartment. Here in Israel, it's a very, very sensitive issue. I'm sure there too, because of Kiddush Hashem and Chil Hashem. But here, we are so super sensitive, because many of the residents in the apartment house are not yet religious, and they want to get access to the opening of the house. And because we took over the chatzer, they can't do so. But if it's a religious person who wants to get access to his apartment, and here we have two explanations for what the reason is for not walking against the mispal Dalet Amos. According to one, it's because you'll interfere with his kavana. And the poskim quote a very, very famous tshuva based on the Chaye Adam, that if a person puts himself in a situation where other people are going to have to get by, and he's blocking their exit, their entrance, in such a case, kevon shespal b'makom shiyafriyu lo, olava iser, v'ein b'kocho lesar l'achirin. You decided to daven there in a place where people need access to get to their apartments. That's your problem. However, the Eish al Avram and other poskim say that the reason for the Iser of Al Yavar Lifnei HaMispal is because it's a Mokom Shechina and there's a radius of 4 Amos around the Mispal. It could be that you're not allowed to even walk behind the Mispal, even though you're not going to interfere with this tefillah. And according to that school of thought, for sure, you would not be allowed to walk in front of the Mispalel. And at the end of this tshuva, from Rabbi Yitzhak Zilberstein, nonetheless, no less, he says that even if I assume that the reason for this Iser is because you have rights to have total kavana, but nevertheless, you had reshus from the members of the apartment to use the chatzar for tefillah. You didn't, in Hebrew it's called polesh. How do you say that in English when you just, decide to take over someone's property? It's called polesh. I don't know, I'll have to look it up in a dictionary how you say it in English. I'm sure there's an English word for it. You know, like a squatter kind of thing. You weren't a polesh. You can't just have a shul and a synagogue in someone's chatzar. You have to get reshus for that. Once you get reshus, then the other people have no right to say, well, you can't aser us, you can't generate an iser on us to go within 4 amos of your tefillah, because, as Rav Zilberstein says, by giving haskoma, by giving permission to the people to set up the tefillah, there's a tacit agreement that they have rights to daven in the chatzar, and therefore, you know, we don't have a claim against them. Hey, why did you daven in a place which would interfere with my access to my house? And finally, the last tshuva, just to give me a sense of joy that I covered all the topics that I prepared for today, is the case of Kiddush. Here's an interesting case. Because you're in Bidud, you're in quarantine, you cannot be out there to participate in the Kiddush. You're in a different room. Or, alternatively, you're the Makadesh on behalf of your family, but you're in quarantine. So you can't be in the same room in order to recite Kiddush on their behalf. And here I was absolutely fascinated. The poskim say hands down, without a shaila, that you could be Yotzei Kiddush from another room, or you could be Motzei Kiddush from another room. And the only stipulation is that the room be slightly ajar. That the door, excuse me, be slightly ajar. So Rabosai, this is where we'll conclude for today. Baruch Hashem, we covered a vast, vast number of shilas in Corona. And I'd like to, throw the floor out for questions.
Just a quick question. If the issue is one...
Is that my phone or yours?
No, that's here.
Oh, okay. It sounds exactly like my phone. Yeah.
Maybe I'm calling there. But yeah. If the issue with regards to the gug is a question of sakana, okay, then would you say that the same halachas would apply if you're in a parking lot?
Because a car's coming in, you mean?
Right. They would have to put up some kind of a fence, some kind of barrier.
More like a hecker. I mean, you know, I don't think you could put up a barrier that would withstand the, you know, the impact of a moving car. Yeah. I don't know. Yeah. But some sort of a hecker.
Right. Some kind of.
You know, I'd like to research that further, Joe. I'm not familiar. I don't think here in Israel it's as popular as it is in Chutzlitz. I've seen videos in New York, especially in Deal, New Jersey, the Sephardi community. They have a massive synagogue in a parking lot because the parking lots in that area are very, very large. I'm not sure how it works. I'd like to believe, but maybe this is, I'm being naive, that during the time of the services, they don't allow cars to come in and out. But if the Metzius is not like that, and cars are coming in and out, well, that could be really dangerous, especially for children.
Wouldn't be all Maka, it's just the Sakana.
Right, Maka requires a base Dira and a Gag, but Lotosim Dom Vesecha, for sure, and that's why I say a Hecker would work here according to everyone. You know, put up a sign that would either tell the people who are davening, you know, be careful or stay within a very restricted area so that you're not exposed to any cars coming into park, or a sign that might indicate to the drivers that, you know, there's a service going on over here and therefore don't, you know, don't drive into that area. But that's an excellent question. I want to think about that.
Pandemic is over with, for whatever reason it is. Does that mean that the shemesh goes away, or is it still there?
Again, if they're not davening there anymore, I'm assuming a metzius, you can change the facts on the ground that they're only davening there because of the closure of the shuls. Once the shuls open,
yeah.
I thought you were going to ask me, do the contributors, those who paid from pocket to set up the market, do they have rights to get the, you know, get some element of reimbursement if the market is worth something? You know, it could be reestablished elsewhere. Now, I mentioned something to David. David, you remind me, and I don't know how to research this. So maybe you could help me. And this is relevant every Shabbos in our shul. Because of the Kriyas HaTorah restrictions, the health department requires that we set up a lumdish word, a mechitza, between the Balkore and the Ola. I don't know if you've had, do you encounter that in your part? It's kind of like a folding divider. And I just simply don't have right now the time and the wherewithal, you know, the source material to check this out. I thought I would find it here in this. It seems to me that there's a separate Isur, it's a sugya in Sukkah, about setting up a Dofen HaSukkah on Shabbos. And the reason for that is a mechitza is considered mechze kibonet. Now, obviously, the answer here is that it's only temporary. But nevertheless, there's a concept called Osa Mitchila B'derech HaRoy. So if you're Mosif on an OL, there's already an OL, and just adding onto the OL in a temporary way, that might be Mutal Chatchila. But if, on the other hand, you're creating an OL that didn't exist before, and it's temporary, that's also, that's a Shvus D'Rabbanan on Shabbos. Here, obviously, you're creating something new. And the only answer I have is a sugya in Beitza, which is called, I don't know if you're familiar with it, Mita Shel Prakim, which is a sugya about, you know, folding beds, you know, or folding tables. So that it's not only temporary, but it's permanently temporary, meaning there's no chash that you'll knock any nails in. You understand what I mean? Because the legs of the table are attached to the table. It's just a matter of opening them and closing.
I thought if it's meant to be taken apart always, then you're allowed to put it up.
So the question is how you learn Mita Shel Prakim. Is Mita Shel Prakim because it's meant to be opened and closed? Like, for example, you have knapsacks, you know, that you put on your back, so you have to open the steel part, you know, the real fancy, sturdy knapsacks, but you take it off your back and you close it again. So you open and close it, and that's this case. Or should we say that Mita Shel Prakim is because there's already an attachment between the legs and the bed. And in that case, I'm a little bit iffy about the you know, about this kind of divider. I'm not sure. There should be something in the poskim about it. I'm sure it's mutter, but I'd like to see that. Also, in terms of Kriyas HaTorah, I asked this question to David yesterday. Maybe you know the answer. The poskim allow, in the present situation, to call up brothers, one after the other, which normally we avoid because of Ayin Hara, whatever it might be. But you know what? You know, you have two brothers, and there's no chashash that one will... You know, they live together and so for one family. But I was wondering, since there's another option of calling up the same Ola time after time, which I don't know, again, what you're used to in your synagogue, but that's what we do in our synagogue. Yeah. Maybe, therefore, let's avoid the normal prohibition of calling up two brothers. Let's decide on this Shabbos, Yankel, the older brother, will get all the aliyahs, and next Shabbos we'll give it to Beryl, the younger brother. So also, let me just make a general plea, if I can. And, you know, the work is on my shoulders, but it's gotten to the point where I'm not finding online any help. Meaning, for months and months, I was able to access certain different sites and gather together different shilas and tshuvas that were relevant to Piskei Karona. For some reason, again, it's probably my fault, but I can't seem to find anything anymore. I had a journal that used to come out weekly, which is called Emek HaLocha, or Emek HaPshat, and every week they had another Shaila in Corona. It was wonderful. Now, they're going off on Hilchos Shabbos questions, and, you know, I wanted to use this time period. So, I'm just pleading, I'm just putting out a bakasha there. If you have any access to anything online, you know, maybe you could take the time and, you know, Google different things. Rav Shechter used to publish almost on a regular basis, Piskei Karona. I haven't seen one in months, or at least in a month. So I'm sort of feeling the pressure on my shoulders weekly, you know. So I have this Sefer, and Baruch Hashem, I think we've almost completely... Again, the Sefer is hundreds of pages long, but I think we've pretty much... you know, covered all of it. Again, there are nuances that we didn't cover, but the real, you know, bombastic shilas, I mean, there are issues here about Nida, but, you know, mikvos, and that's a little bit too complicated for us, I think. So again, I'm just throwing it out there. If you, in any way, could, you know, could help me with that, take a little bit of the burden. Once you tell me where to look, or you send me a link, I'll be needed to do the research. There was recently a psak, apparently, from Rav Sternbach, which I can't get a hold of, it's certainly not online, that we could defy, again, I didn't say that Rav Sternbach said this, I'm just saying this is the way it was presented to me, that you could defy the law against teaching in yeshivas, because for Talmud Torah, we have to be moser nefesh. And the Gemara says about Rabbi Akiva, that he compares the Jewish nation to the fish, and just like the fish out of water will die, the Jewish people out of Talmud Torah without Talmud Torah will die. Again, he doesn't know about Zoom. You know, in his context, they don't learn on Zoom like we do. We're the Moderna show, because we use Zoom, right? So, you know, something like that would be great, great material for our weekly discussion. So, again, I don't know how to get access to it. I just heard about it. I also heard about an issue which is fascinating to me, that now, again, in this part of the world at least, they decide sometimes on a wedding at the last minute. Let's say, for example, for a day or so, the government loosens the requirements, they allow a larger wedding. So overnight, they decide to invite their people and they set up a wedding. And there's a real serious shaila of what's called dam chimud. That's a neither shaila. Very fascinating shaila. So again, you know, I know about all these questions that are coming up almost on a daily basis, but I just don't have access to them. There doesn't seem to be, in all the links that I'm using, any presentation on the internet of these shaila. So again, it's just a personal bakasha, if you could help me with that.
So we covered a wide range of different shailas.
today in the shir, starting with issues of Nezikin, issues about Makeh. We even touched on the question of Edus at a wedding, about Kiddush for someone who's in Bidud, and whether you're allowed to pass in front of those who are Mispalel out in a Chotzer. Of course, the main topic for today perhaps was the Makeh issue. There are, issues in Makeh which are general issues, but they have a specific application in our situation of davening in a place. Now, Joe, at the end of the shiur, asked me a question about the safety issues in a minyan that's taking place in a parking lot, because sometimes cars come in and they dangerously back into a spot. They don't see one of the mispalim. So certainly we have to take whatever precautions, lo tosim dom ve'secha and ushmartim yodis nafshaseichem, in order to protect that. And David asked me the question about Emirz Hashem, when we could start davening back in the shul. We've already put a makeh up on the roof. Would we be required to keep the roof there, keep the makeh there? I mean, I would assume that once we go back into the shul, from that point and on, we have no requirement of a makeh. I would just add a question as to whether or not the donors who contributed to the makeh, they have rights to get back their makeh if it's worth something on the market. Okay then, so thank you very much. This is where we'll conclude for today.